hesitant and didn't want to do stuff with anyone else. And then a few weeks ago, he wrote to me and he sent me a new song via the internet. And it's a great song, and I think he wants to be a hip-hop artist.
That's terrific.
Say that again?
What's he call himself?
Toño. The song is titled Me Confundieron. They confused me with somebody else.
And how typical is this case of what one might see in the criminal justice system in Mexico? Is this a dramatic example of travesty of justice, or how common are these things?
Well, one of the things that led us to pick his case, in addition to being moved by what was happening, was that several people called us after we made El Tunnel, including the brother of President Salinas, who at the time was in prison, Raul Salinas, and we chose not to help him. But Toño's case is a routine homicide case. You know, it's like other cases that we saw, it's a case where there's no physical evidence. It's all based on an eyewitness. We have, he was not shown an arrest warrant, like 93% of all the inmates in Mexico. There was no judge in his trial hearings, and he got convicted in his first trial and in his retrial.
I would add that this was specifically very important for us to have the typical case. Mm-hmm. And after collecting statistics, it was just a witness testimony, a routine case. It was not politically driven. It was not a high-profile case. So it was beautiful to see it just like right in the median of the distribution, in the average.
Mm-hmm. And I guess also, you can see how powerful is the system. It's unbeatable because we now get a second chance. We have a retrial. We have a chance to film the retrial. So there's 5 cameras. There's a top defense attorney. Rafael Heredia used to be the president of the criminal justice chapter of the Mexican Bar Association. So a top lawyer. We were advising Toño with everything we knew. Mm-hmm. Her mother was a legislator at the time. Mm-hmm. and it doesn't matter to the system. So it's so in the belief that it's doing the right thing, it doesn't take into account that it might be making a mistake.
I think one of the things that really struck me as somebody who teaches American criminal procedure is how little separation there is between the judge and the prosecutor and the police officers. How it appears to be all part of the same apparatus, that there's not even the facade of people being set apart and there being the appearance of neutrality. Is there anything in Mexican law that requires neutrality or?
Yes, we do have in the Constitution the right to a fair impartial trial. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Mexico even copied the U.S. Constitution, and so it's... the legal language in some respects is similar, but the implementation has always been the challenge for Mexico. The first time a fair trial was mentioned for Mexicans to have a right to a fair trial, it was mentioned in 1814, mm-hmm. in the Apatzingan Constitution. And the trouble has always been implementation for Mexico. We've tried, and there's been several amendments to Mexico's constitution, and the most recent one was in 2008, thanks in part to the fact that we showed El Túnel in the Mexican Congress. An amendment was passed to Mexico's constitution requiring fair trials and presumption of innocence. And I think the real challenge is going to be implementation. Mm-hmm. I think the big problem is that we have... trials that are not neutral. You don't have a neutral perspective of the person who's being tried. The only perspective that the judge has is Toño behind bars. He doesn't have the perspective that you have as an audience of this film. You don't get to see, the judge doesn't get to see him as a person. Mm-hmm. I think he gets to see him only as a likely criminal that he has to contain inside that prison. And that's what needs to change. If we could get rid of those bars, if we could get him to sit dressed as a civilian in that courtroom, that would make a huge, huge difference. And I think like that, there's other problems we've identified that it's simple changes. Many of them are just architectural changes that could bring change. So it's not about what the Constitution says. It's about what the environment, what the court system is like.
So we have some more questions along the same lines. So we've seen that the idea is that the presumption of innocence is only going to be introduced in 2016. And people are asking, what are the chances that there's going to be reform? And I'm curious why there's such a delay.
This was one of the, well, it is logical that we need a time frame to change the whole system from top to bottom. But it is true that we're using this movie actually to achieve those changes. We see in this movie the possibility of enriching the debate around implementation of this constitutional amendment. And that is the beauty and the power of the images. We don't have to use statistics. We can use this story, one single story, to depict a problem and to have an emotional sort of vehicle to express a systematic problem in the criminal justice system. So we believe that this showing this movie in Mexico will make that change. And I wanted to tell you, where are we now in terms of using the film? Mm-hmm. It has been shown everywhere in the world. It has been shown in the UK just a couple of weeks ago, nationally, in the US, reaching 1 million as an audience in PBS. But unfortunately, we haven't been able to show it in Mexico, only in two festivals, just like six screenings, and that's it. But right now, we got an offer from the most important chain in Mexico, theaters. They have 60% of all screens in the country, and it's the fourth largest theater company in the world. And they said, we're going to screen Presunto Culpable, Presumed Guilty, as without charge. Mm. That's an incredible opportunity. So we said, yeah, like the best movies everywhere in the country, the best sound. Now we have to fill those movie theaters. And they offered to screen simultaneously up to 300 copies. Mm-hmm. Up to 300 times, no, the Presunto Culpable.
There's 2,000 screens from Cinepolis in the country, so that's a
more
pretty large
10%.
Number. And it also means for them a huge sacrifice, because every screen that they separate for Presunto Culpable means Harry Potter is out. So they are asking for help to do this, because it's the craziest non-for-profit thing they've done. They want us to find sponsors for the copies, the celluloid copies, and they're asking for sponsors for publicity. So we're in the middle of this, and there's a release date. The theatrical release date is going to be February 11th. So we got 3 months to pull this off.
Have the court officials seen the film? Any of the police officers or the judge or anybody in the system?
I don't know. I don't think that the detective that arrested Tonya has seen the film. I don't think he goes to film festivals. Or has access to PBS. But I'm sure he'll find out. One of the poster's proposals that I had was him like going I don't know if they'll do it, but I'm sure he'll find out soon enough. But I know for sure that the judge, not the judge who convicts Tonio, but the judge who finally sets him free, he went to one of our screenings, and his family came to the screening, and they were very moved, and they were in tears about this.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Several people are curious about the filmmaking and you as filmmakers. How did you get permission to film inside the courtroom?
You want me to answer?
Go ahead.
Well, it was very complicated to get permission to film. It was a chess game, I would say. And I'm still not sure how we pulled it off. I guess we looked incompetent. We didn't look threatening, I think. And at the same time, I can only speculate what happened, but I think that we did get the sympathy of people who are in the high-ranking positions in the courts because they want to see change. I think nobody likes a system like this. Mm-hmm. And while you're in that system, it's really difficult, I guess, to do something. And we came in and we presented to them an opportunity to do something good. And we had to make our case to 7 different administrations because it involves the prison authorities, the prosecution, the defense bar, the courts, and we negotiated our access 7 times because there were changes. Mexico is a very politically unstable country, and these institutions reflect that. Mm-hmm. And we always got access again and again to film.
So yes, I must say that it took us 1 full year to get the first 15-minute access to the first interview for Tonio. Mm. Just 1 year for 15 minutes. And then we had to negotiate our access every time. And we are not missing 1 single minute from the trial.
And this is all filmed 24 as hours. The events take place. None of this is reenacted.
That's incredible, yes. And I think that is...
Well, I can't get the policeman to reenact something if I didn't get...
But I guess it's the uniqueness of this documentary is that without planning it, it started to unfold and we had the cameras and it's not retrospective, it's not interview driven, it's just following the reality as it's happening.
And I guess that's one of the reasons why it's done well in film festivals. I think filmmakers and jurors in the film festivals recognize that it's very difficult to do something like this. And it's also one of the reasons why Cinepolis, this theater chain, is going to put it on the screens because they feel it has all the elements that any work of fiction could offer.
Right.
So I think it really is an opportunity to present the ideas of presumption of innocence and the value of due process to everybody. It's mm-hmm. I think it's something that everybody might be interested in, ready to consume. It's not very... It's a difficult film to watch emotionally, but it's also something that everybody can relate to and understand.
Mm-hmm. As to your double role as lawyers and filmmakers, how does it feel to be in this situation where on one hand you're documenting something as it's happening, and on the other hand there's this push to get involved because you're seeing this tragic injustice taking place?
Well, if I may, or you want to. Yeah.
I would say that we would have even a third role as Tonio's friends because you become very close to them. After collecting statistics for such a long time, you hear these terrible stories, but they become a number so quickly. But then you have one single man, and then you're pushing all your energy towards that. And I can tell you that while we were shooting this, just a few days after Tonio was convicted, we were able to pass the constitutional amendment of 2008, that would change the whole system in the whole country. And we were part of that lobby, trying to push that constitutional amendment. But we had just lost the battle, won the war, and we felt so miserable because it was Tonio, it was his real life, and you could dimension the scope of the drama.
Mm-hmm. And I would accept that it's not a balanced film.
Mm-hmm.
It's
not a balanced system.
It's not a balanced system. Yes, but I recognize that, and it's not what we were trying to achieve. Even if I did try to get access to the policeman to interview them, mm-hmm. and to the judge. To this day, he never responded for comment. Even also in October last year, after we won a very important film festival in Morelia, the Wall Street Journal decided to write an article on this story because when we won the prize, the festival decided to make a public screening of this documentary, and they put up a huge screen next to the cathedral in Morelia. And I was really nervous about it because at the same time there was going to be a soccer game with Mexico's national team deciding whether they were going to go to South Africa. And I thought, well, nobody's going to show up to this. And I was wrong. We estimate that about 2,000 people came, and it was a huge, I think the chairs were almost as uncomfortable as this one, and people stayed. And it was just a fabulous, fabulous moment. So I think it does have a chance. And but the Wall Street Journal ran an article, and it was the front page article that weekend, which also was unexpected, to get that newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Basically, where we're seeing justice being done here is on appeal, and people would like to know how typical it is to be granted an appeal, and if you have any notion of what percentage of appeals in Mexico are successful.
Yeah.
20% of appeals in Mexico City
are successful.
But are you successful.
Do you mean they're successful? Or okay.
Yes.
So 20% of appeals are successful, but only 2% of people who lose or get convicted
manage
to appeal. So
that's 0.7% of all cases.
Right.
Basically.
And there's also a very different system from the U.S. So these decisions have no precedential value. Mm-hmm. So you can win an appeal and it means nothing for the rest of the cases.
Of course. Several people have asked questions about how class and gender and issues like that play into this whole system, whether you're seeing classism at work here, whether women are treated in peculiar ways.
Mm-hmm. Totally, yes. Women, poor. Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I guess every criminal justice system tends to discriminate or tend to be to punish poverty. But there are degrees as well, I guess.
Lida has done some surveys. Many of the statistics that you saw come from those surveys. And in them, she found that about 70% of the prison population is there for petty thefts, survival thefts almost. And there's 20% who are more only a few more serious crimes, and now we know what's behind, mm-hmm. you know, those numbers. So it's really cases with very poor evidence. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we find worrying is that when we can compare Mexico City, the efficiency to solve theft, for example, is almost as high as Scotland Yard's. So that means there's likely a lot of innocent mm-hmm. people in prison.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'd like to hear, I think, a little bit more about what exactly this legal reform that might be happening, partly as a result of El Túnel, includes. So to what extent does, you know, the amount of suspicion factor in here, to what extent does less reliance on written records? What is actually going to be the effect of this reform beyond the statement that there's a presumption of innocence?
Wow, well, what a great question. So that's, in fact, up for grabs. Right now, mm-hmm. A constitution can only do so much to define what's going to happen in the future criminal trials. And we've been struggling to strengthen the implementation structures to have a commission with centralized power to surveil what every state in Mexico is doing. We've been struggling to define the problem in terms of how the defendant is presented to the courtroom. Mm-hmm. To have a standard to test the evidence, for example, reasonable doubt would be a good thing to have as a standard to test evidence. So, these are, I think, the defining moments of that debate. Mm-hmm. I think we've been able to present a story, a dramatic story, which just we can only, I guess, start imagining what the problems are. But we need to fill in the blanks and define a solution in very specific ways. I think it will require legislation. Mexico is a federation like the United States, so you need state-by-state legislation defining, what are your rights where you're in custody in the police. Mm-hmm. We would need to have videotape recording of police interrogations would have made a huge difference in this case. Mm-hmm. A videotape recording of the trial would have made a huge difference. Mm-hmm. If those two measures were routine, that would help enormously.
Yes, and I guess even though the implementation is so complex, we are thinking about that as well. First, we want to screen the movie because even you cannot imagine, but Mexicans believe that we have a system like the one that there is in the U.S. with a jury and the judge present, and because there's such an influence from the United States.
Because that's what they see on TV.
Of the visual image of justice. So they don't even know this is happening, and I think it's revealing. So that's why our first step is really to screen the movie to the widest audience in Mexico. And as a second step, we have decided that taped interrogations, custodial interrogations by the police, and taping the procedure is so important in terms of transparency and accountability. So that's one of the things that we're actively pursuing, and that it's observable, that it's measurable, besides the full implementation from the beginning to end, from arrest to the verdict. No,
there's there seems to be a huge backstory to the picture that we're seeing here in terms of how the system works. What role does bribery and corruption play in all of this?
It's terrible, and I guess it's the other piece of that we don't develop it very much in the story, but you have this propensity of convicting innocents and at the same time permeability to corruption increases the likelihood that the real criminals are in the streets, no? And it's widely known, and it's the expectation even at surveys to inmates that you can bribe the police and get your ticket, your release ticket, right? So, and the advice for any lawyer, any criminal lawyer in Mexico is just bribe yourself out. It's easier with the police, it's less easy at the prosecutor office, and then it's less likely at the trial level, but it's definitely the norm. So if you have like high propensity to corruption, and then you have quotas of indictment, quotas for conviction, and this, the innocents are more at risk, actually, no, because they think somebody will notice that they're innocent, and you just have the conviction machine at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would add that there's many. It's obvious that it's a very corrupt system, but I think what is less obvious is why is it so corrupt? Why anybody you place in that system will end up taking a bribe, or very frequently, as the surveys show, abusing prisoners or detainees. And I think it's in part the lack of supervision. If, for example, if we were to videotape police interrogations, I'm pretty sure we would not see a 40% rate of that we see today of torture or mistreatment of detainees. And I'm sure if we had a different management system, instead of having arrest quotas like we do, and if we had a different management system, for example, one that lets detectives actually investigate something, mm-hmm. We have really absurd shifts that don't let anybody do any investigation even if they wanted to, we would begin to see better quality police work, and we would begin to see, you know, better quality human beings interested in taking those positions. So those are two big corrupting influences in the system.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk these days in California about our correctional crisis, which sort of pales with much of the footage in prison that we've seen here. And the arguments that are being made here for diminishing prison population is arguments regarding cost. We're spending a lot of money on harsh justice, and we're imprisoning occasionally the wrong people. And I'm wondering sort of what type of advocacy is being made on behalf of reform. When people try to reform the system in Mexico, do people talk about costs? Do they talk about the need to you know, reduce crime rates by reducing recidivism rather than this? What sort of arguments are being made to improve the system?
The predominant request from citizens is higher penalties, death penalty, and more money.
And more police.
So which we believe is the incorrect policy.
Better police, probably.
Yes. So
start.
Right now we have more police in Mexico per capita than Iraq.
So it's so what we are trying to do with this film is when you feel you're in Tonya's shoes, it allows like opens a door to change the perspective and think in other terms, and that's why we need to have these policy proposals ready. If we get access to a microphone once the movie is out there. And we are receiving requests from Univision, from CNN, saying, we want to interview. And it's like, not yet. Wait for February because we want to just like make it a blast. But before we finish, because I think we're close to finish, I want to thank the World Affairs Council for giving us this space. It's incredible the amount of support that we've had in this country, and we feel so much part of it right now, especially from the Bay Area, almost like a center of gravity, because this couldn't have been possible without us being in Berkeley with the professors that we have, with the theories that we've learned. And all of them are there, not explicit. They're not interviews from our professors, but what we learn about biases and about due process and about context making the difference instead of persons, no? They are there. And right now, we have the San Francisco Film Society as our sponsor, and they are receiving the donations for our cause and for our movement, and we're very, very grateful.
And I also brought a flyer if you're interested in supporting this, and I'm going to put it out on a table, but because it's a complicated website from the San Francisco Film Society, but you can donate through their website. So
we just have time for a couple more questions.
Yeah.
Several people are concerned for your safety, it seems. People are mentioning that journalists in Mexico have been targeted for exposing corruption, and I'm wondering to what extent are you guys, Antonio, compromised in Mexico, having exposed this sort of thing?
I guess we are, and we accept that, and it's okay.
Yes, and we try to be cautious. But we talk about it because it would be naive not to talk about it, no? Mm-hmm. And we say, well, even from the beginning, like, we are going to put the cameras there and the police officer is going to be there. And Tonio's fear is also, we could share that. And we're just trying to protect Tonio. We feel he's the most vulnerable. Finally, we're here. But we have more hope than fear, I would say. He's just like, yeah.
Well, I have time for one final question. So you guys are now not only lawyers and filmmakers, but you're also academics. Any publications or any plans with your graduate studies that have anything to do with this?
Well, very recently, we just got invited to a conference, the first international conference on wrongful conviction, which is organized by the Innocence Project. Mm-hmm. And we're supposed to write a paper by April to present it at that conference. We got the invitation, there's two versions of that invitation that we got, and one was like about a year and a half ago. So I hope we will make time to put down in writing what we've learned. So far, it's really been a delight to us completing our PhDs.
Well, and it's been a delight for us to watch your incredible film. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, the ACLU of Northern California, and the UC Berkeley Human Rights Center, I would like all of you to join me in thanking these incredible people for this film.